That was Indigenous cellist and composer Chris Dirksen's Treaties from the album The Visit. Dirksen has been the collaborative composer for the latest iteration of the Art of Healing program held by the TSO and the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. This program brings together traditional knowledge and medical expertise in the establishment of a culturally safe space to support patients' mental well-being. Now, they work together with Dirksen and TSO musicians to produce a piece of music, and the full orchestral version will be heard next spring, but you can preview the chamber music version on November 27th as a pre-concert performance before Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. The TSO chamber soloists will perform at 6:30. You're listening to Sunday Night at the TSO. So I'm Kathleen Kajioka. Well, Dirksen is not the only Canadian compositional talent you can take in that night. One of the next-gen composers, Sophie Dupuis, will have her work, Les Aventures de Sarah, premiered at Roy Thompson Hall on November 27th and 30th. From and based in New Brunswick, Sophie has received many grants and awards, including having been chosen by composer James Rolfe to receive the Joanna Metcalf Performing Arts Prize Protégé Award, and by contemporary voice specialist Janice Jackson to share the Friends of Canadian Music Award. Her album received a 2024 Music New Brunswick Awards nomination for Recording of the Year. To talk about her process and her new work, she joins me now. Sophie Dupuis, welcome to Sunday Night at the TSO.
Thank you for having me.
We have some get-to-know-you questions. Are you ready?
Yes.
What is your favorite non-classical, non-orchestral song or piece of music, and why?
Well, it does depend on the era I live in. Right now, my favorite song is called Je l'aime à mourir by Francis Cabrel. So I do love the French songs that came out from that era in the late 70s, 80s, because it's very poetic. So everything is really thought out. This one is particularly playful. It talks about, funny story. So to me, it was Francis Cabrel talking to his child. And then my partner said, well, you know, he's talking to his lover. And I was really upset because I was singing this song while I was pregnant with my daughter. And to me, it was a song to my daughter. But no, it's really a song to his lover. And there are some racy lines really wrapped into poetry that I didn't really quite get the sense.
So it almost translates, but not quite.
Yeah. So anyway, but yeah, to me, it's a lovely, lovely song. Yeah.
What's your favorite instrument in the orchestra?
That's a tough one. Because I'm a string player, I tend to gravitate towards string sections. My music tends to be a little bit more fluid. So I like to morph it a little bit like Play-Doh, and string sections really help me do that. Although I had the chance to work closely with clarinetists in the past, and I do have a soft spot for the clarinet.
Okay. What's your favorite comfort meal?
Indian food.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. Do you have a particular favorite area or location in Toronto?
You know, I'm ashamed to say, I did live in Toronto for 7 years while I was a student. So I was very much stuck in my studies, and I didn't quite explore the city as much as I had the opportunity to. But I have vivid memories of the distillery district during Nuit Blanche. And to me, those were always the best events held there. And I just loved the gloomy atmosphere that was there, and that holds so much history. But yeah, with the performers and the art there, it was just oozing of creativity. I just love that space.
Tell us about your musical background. I understand you're a violinist. Let's start with that.
Yes, a bit of history for you. So I grew up in a rural area, a French-speaking area in New Brunswick, and it's very much rural. It's one of the bigger cities in New Brunswick, but it's still remote in a lot of ways. a lot of the important services and institutions that were established were done so by religious congregations early on. And we saw a lot of schools and universities and hospitals being built by these religious congregations. And over time, of course, the secular system kind of slowly took over those institutions. But particularly in remote areas, these congregations had the funds and the resources to put these resources in place. So I was born at the end of the 80s and grew up in the 90s. And so we saw, of course, the transition already happened, but we still had some reminiscence of this sort of enterprise by religious congregations. So a few decades prior, there was this priest who was established in our community, and he had learned violin. He was by no means a professional, but he had to learn violin through the Suzuki method and decided to teach the nuns violin while teaching them how to teach. And that way, these nuns would teach classrooms and they would teach violin. So you had whole classrooms learning violin and other string instruments.
Oh, wow.
It was by no means technically accurate or the best. You know, it was very, very modest music learning, but it wasn't about having the perfect technique. It was about creating an opportunity to have kids get in touch with music, learn a sense of community and achievement, also contributing to that liveliness of having music around. And by the time I came around, you know, nuns were not necessarily learning in schools anymore, but we still had that school that existed that was put on by this priest. And it was very much part of our community. You know, a lot of kids my age would go through that school. Yeah, so that's how I started learning the instrument. I learned violin. That was what was available. And further on in university, you know, I got really, really self-conscious about what I knew and what I didn't know about the violin. But at least it got me started in music. That's what was really, really important.
At what point did you decide, or was it clear to you that you wanted to take music as a career path?
Probably at the university level. I did go in university thinking I would become a physician. So I started a Bachelor of Music and Science because I wasn't ready to let go of music quite yet. And because of the scheduling, actually it was a scheduling problem with the different departments that forced me to pick one or another. And I decided to do music, and because I'm a bit of a rebel at heart, I had some people telling me, well, you know, you're more suited to science than music. And because I love a good challenge, I just continued in music. And I must say that it was, for a long time, it was a choice to continue in music. I hadn't kind of made the choice to, yes, definitely go in music. I kind of made it along the way. And even after my doctorate, it was a question of, do I still want to do this, or do I want to redefine my career path? It's very much choosing the art every day.
And at what point did composition come into this?
I guess I was creating from a very young age, and I didn't quite know how to call it. I wasn't big into practicing, for sure. Mm-hmm. To our teacher's dismay, it really wasn't a priority for us. We wanted to do music because we liked playing and being together and whatnot. So at home, I would pick up my instrument. I also took piano along the line, and I would play, but not play the instrument. I would just play around and find different sounds and whatnot. And I guess I didn't have a whole lot of exposure to different kind of classical music. My dad loved his Mozart and Beethoven, and that was about it. I didn't quite have the curiosity at the time to go seek different type of music. It would be a lot easier today with the internet and YouTube, but at the time it wasn't really available and I wasn't really seeking it either. But I had heard, I don't know in what context, I had heard something that I would define as some kind of Boulez piano works. And I decided to play my own version of that. So I would create shapes on the keys, on the piano. My parents must have thought I was absolutely insane, but to me that was music, and I would connect with that a lot more than, you know, the classical tunes that we would be told to play. I guess that would be my early creations. Yeah, and then at university, you know, you have options in courses, and then I saw this composition course. Okay, I'll take that. Yeah, it was kind of now formally doing something that I had been doing before, but it was really calling it composition.
Right. Right. From going from making stuff up to composition.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, you were part of the Next Gen Composers program. How's your experience been so far working with the TSO's new music team?
It's been really amazing. I must say that getting a call from the TSO being asked to write a music as part of this program, it's very intimidating at first because there's a lot of unwritten rules when it comes to working with an orchestra and etiquettes that you might not be aware of. And it's a lot of pressure just going into it and trying to figure out what is the best way to communicate and go about things and whatnot. It's been so much easier having this human contact with the composers who are part of the team. So Emily LaBelle, the composer advisor, and Liam Ritz, the RBC affiliate composer. They're some of the nicest people I've met, and they made this much more approachable and the process human in some way. It was really a learning opportunity to be told, okay, well, you know, your parts should look a certain way. And then we'd receive feedback on what these parts should look like or how I should modify my score so it would be much more legible. And, you know, they'd catch a few typos along the way. So it's really reassuring to have this opportunity to make mistakes in a very secure environment while dealing with such a prestigious ensemble. And I must say too that it's very clear that the TSO is putting a lot of faith and value in composers for putting this program on. But you can see it in their team. Like, they have a new music coordinator, Marlena Pellegrino, who has been just awesome. I just feel like royalty walking into this because they take really good care of their composers. And it's not about being babied, but it's also not about being thrown in the deep end. It's just about creating a good, positive collaboration with an ensemble. And I very much appreciate that.
What is the importance of new composer programs such as this to the music industry?
Well, it's just putting value into living composers, really. Into what artists today are doing. And it's so important. Of course, we'd want to argue that what we do is important. And I guess it feels always like a fight to justify what we do on so many levels, like with the government, yes, but sometimes with your family. You know, you always have like a cousin, a sister, or an aunt who's like, but exactly what do you do? They don't quite understand. But, you know, art is part of everyone's everyday life. When you think about an ordinary day, you wake up, you know, you drink your coffee. Well, there's been an amount of thought into assembling that coffee and roasting it. the mug you drink from has been designed. You hop in your car while your car has been designed and the colors have been selected. You walk in the building. The building has been designed by an architect and dressed with an interior designer. You turn on the radio. There are songs that have been made by people who really worked on their craft. And that list of songs is curated by a radio host. And I can go on and on. And of course, these are very practical things. But if you think about it, these artists have become artists because they had the opportunity to explore. To become a wholesome artist, you have to have training, but also life experience. And, you know, designing a cup might be just a contract along the way. And yes, it's very practical, but you had someone really think about that art and design. So it's not negligible. I think it's just about putting value in those artists and saying, hey, we are giving you a platform and a place. And that really shows the public then, oh, there is value into this person. And then maybe the community will start putting value into these things as well.
I'd love to chat about the work that you have written for the TSO, Les Aventures de Sarah, which will be performed in November, November 27th and 30th, as part of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. Now, what was your starting point for this work?
You know, I guess the biggest guideline to be mindful of when receiving commission is the time, at least to me. So the piece had to last 5 minutes. Well, that gives you kind of an idea of how much material you'll be able to put in. So, of course, if I tackle a topic that is very complicated and intricate, I might not have time to develop it. So I took a very simple idea that could also foster some instinct a little bit more. So I guess it's a more instinctive piece for me than planned out and thought of. Either way, I wouldn't have time to develop more complicated material. And I did have a whole plan for this piece, and I had to throw it away because I kept wanting to do something else. I wrote the piece during the first year of life of my daughter. And yeah, because we wanted to do everything just right, one of the advice is that you must talk a lot to your child. And that really forced us to dive back in nursery rhymes and little stories. And they have really lovely books now that are super imaginative. And I guess my partner and I really had this imaginary world and creative tendencies younger, and that, you know, as adults, you just let go. But yeah, it gave us an opportunity to rediscover this, because of course, when you talk to a baby, there's not a whole lot of feedback. So you have to come up with all the material. One thing I should say first is, you know, throughout history, there was a lot of composers that wrote for their children, lullabies or, you know, a soft piano suite and whatnot. But that kind of music doesn't really speak to me. I mean, it can speak to me. It's just not my language. You know, it wasn't an instinctive idea. But in this context, because we're kind of rediscovering fantastic stories and magical scenarios and whatnot, it made us create this little world of adventures with her daughter. So, you know, one day she's a pirate and another day she's like a plane. Mm-hmm. You know, she loves doing the plane, but and the story is more for us to do, mm-hmm. to do the actions. But, you know, it's been so much fun. So I wanted this piece to be full of adventures and courage and, you know, she's small but mighty type of thing. So that is more my language. Yeah.
Are there particular ways that you use the orchestra, or how? What should listeners keep their ears open for?
The main way I use the orchestra for this is to create magic. I don't know how else to say it, really. It's partly inspired by the rest of the program. To me, Tchaikovsky creates magic in his music. it's easy to get carried in an imaginary story through this music. And I guess that's the goal of it. And in some ways, my piece tells a story and has develops with that in mind, with a child living through these different scenarios. And I really tried to emulate kind of throws of sparkles, if that makes sense, that runs across instruments. So there was a lot of instrumental exchange. And the harmonies are at times a little scary, but there's no great adventure without a little worry, a little scare. So that kind of sums it up.
We look forward to hearing the premiere of Les Aventures de Sarah, and that is happening again November 27th and 30th as part of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. Sophie, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was TSO Next Gen composer Sophie Dupuis. Catch Les Aventures de Sarah November 27th and 30th as part of the program Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. Get tickets and information at tso.ca. And now let's hear from that ballet. Here is the iconic waltz.